Chapter 22. It's Greek to Me by Willie Snow Etheridge. 22. A Night in the Ezark's Bed. Our first night in Bulgaria was spent in the ancient monastery of Rila, which nests like an eagle thousands of feet above sea level in the hollow of the mountains. For an hour after we turned off the highway to Sofia, we climbed steadily upward to reach it. Up and up the jeep panted on a narrow, rocky road through towering firs, which shut us into a twilight world. They were the first real trees we had seen since coming into Bulgaria, and they were a part of the vast domain of the monastery. A toy-like truck with a toy-like train curved near our road to haul the timber down the mountains to the outside world. Here and there we spotted peasants, so dwarfed by the firs they seemed no bigger than gnomes, and for all I knew they were, sawing and splitting logs. The road grew steeper, the gorges deeper, the mountainsides were more nearly perpendicular. A waterfall high above us slithered like a furry white animal over gray boulders. One more curve and we were there. In front of us rose an ancient wall with towers and an arched gateway, and before the gateway stood lines of long-haired black-robed monks with huge crucifixes on their chest, waiting to welcome us. We struggled out of the jeep. A Bulgarian captain, spick and span in a khaki suit with the usual trimmings of red and mirror-bright boots, steps up, clicks heels, bows from the waist, and kisses my hand. Then, straightening himself back and back until I fear he's going to tilt over, he makes a little nosegay of a speech in English. Next, the abbot, huge and rotund, shuffles forward and says a few words in French. Thoroughly welcomed, we are led through the arched gateway into an enormous court, irregularly shaped and surrounded by stucco buildings 3 stories high with galleries extending around all 3 stories, painted loudly in geometric designs. It couldn't be more bizarre, you think, until you see almost in the center of the court a pink stucco church with mosaics of life-size figures on the outside walls and many blue domes. For long minutes, I just stand there on the cobbles of the court, mouth gaping, eyes wide open, and then I look up and see over the roofs the encircling snow-covered mountains, like the whitewashed pickets of a giant fence. Reluctantly, I allow myself to be led by the captain up 3 flights of stairs, uneven with sentries, and along a stretch of gallery to the distant apartment of the head of the entire church of Bulgaria, who is known as the Exarch. Here I am to sleep, the captain informs me, since the Exarch is at present in Sofia. It is a large apartment. There is an entrance hall leading from the gallery, and off the gallery a huge bedroom with oriental rugs on the floor, a private dining room, and a bathroom. With sprightly step, the captain hurries across the bedroom and throws open a window. Ah, the song of the river, he carols happily. Yes, there is definitely the quote-unquote song of the river that rushes from the top of those snow-shawled mountains around the foundations of Rila and on to the valley below. But there is also a blast of cold air that shivers my bones. As soon as the captain departs, I shut the window and lock the bedroom door, but I neglect to shut the door to the entrance hall, which opens onto a gallery, and when I try to go out a little later, I discover it is locked from the outside. On purpose, I wonder. Or had someone passing by and seeing the Exarch's door open and not realizing that the apartment was occupied by a stranger from Kentucky, rushed forward and locked it? The latter, I hope, but I'm not sure. I've heard so many stories of people being kidnapped, imprisoned, tortured, killed. I'm not sure of anything. I try to keep calm and think coolly. Surely there is some way I can get out. I shake the door, which is at least a half foot thick, study the lock, peer through the keyhole. There's no hope here. I could never batter it down. I go back into the bedroom, open the windows, and look out. Though I'm only on the third story, I'm hundreds of feet off the ground and in a wing far removed from the main section of the building. The walls are straight and sheer. There are no vines I can climb down and no galleries on these side away from the courtyard. Out of the window, I see about a quarter of a mile away the parking space in front of the main gate. The cars that brought the other members of the commission are now there, and several of the Bulgarian chauffeurs are still about, chatting. Perhaps I can attract their attention, and one of them will rescue me. But what does one call a chauffeur in Bulgarian? Chauffeur, I begin to scream at the top of my lungs. Chauffeur, chauffeur. Not one of them turns a hair or even raises an eye. They can't hear me, I'm sure. The river drowns my voice beneath its doggone song before it has traveled a yard. But I can't give up. If chauffeur doesn't strike a spark, perhaps another word will. General, I bawl. Colonel, major, captain, lieutenant, sergeant, corporal, private. None of them works. None. I turn back into the room and lie on the bed and count the oriental rugs lapping one on top of each other on the floor. There are 20 of them. A shrine of some kind is in a niche in the far corner of the room. I eye it questioningly. Should I, a non-Catholic, approach it in this hour of distress? I decide against it. I get up and restlessly pace about the room. A large round table covered in heavy brocade centers it. I circle it again and again. Will anybody ever miss me, I wonder? Will Harding or Norbert or Sergeant Baker become concerned about me? I doubt it. I've known young men before. They are, no doubt, rejoicing at having me off their hands. The room is full of shadows. It must be time for dinner or supper or whatever it is one has in these parts. I grow desperate. I take off a shoe and sit on the floor by the door leading to the gallery and beat on it with all the strength of my body. I beat and beat and beat, but nobody comes. Evidently, everybody is in the church at the special service that was scheduled for the delegates, but I still beat and beat. Finally, a voice calls to me in Bulgarian from the other side of the door. I'm locked in, I scream in English. Oh, how terrible, just one moment. A key grates in the lock, and my rescuing prince stands on the threshold. He is a young novice with troubled dark eyes and black curly hair. I thank him and hurry off to find Harding and Norbert and Sergeant Baker. I locate them after quite a search in the parlors of the monastery. They have just returned from the church services, which they say were beautiful and exciting. The abbot spoke briefly, and the monks sang gloriously. And what have you been doing? They ask me indifferently. I tell them with all the stops out, but they are not impressed. I am goaded to asking, would you ever have come to look for me? Certainly not, they chorus simultaneously. Then Norbert, his green eyes bright with teasing, says, the last time we saw you, remember, you were going around corners with that hand-kissing captain. Captain, why should we think you wanted to be rescued? But I'm in no mood for teasing. I began to tell them of my experience. I had just finished my ablutions when you're what? Asked Harding. My ablutions. He looks puzzled. You mean washing? Of course. Then why don't you just say washing? Golly, in a place like this, religious and everything, I thought I should speak biblically. His shoulders crumple over and his chuckles tumble out. I'm gratified, but not for long. Well, if you must speak biblically, he says, the word is ablutions. Oh, yeah. We sit in the big room, waiting for the traditional welcoming suite. The men are tired after the terrific roads and whisper that they hope it will be smooth, something stronger than a suite. The door opens. Monks appear, bearing trays loaded with tiny white cups. Low groans escape in my end of the room. "One more cup of Turkish coffee and I'll," Sergeant Baker mutters. But it is not Turkish coffee. It is steaming hot Slivovitz, a brandy made from plums, the national drink in Bulgaria and, I believe, in Yugoslavia too. It is exceedingly strong and tastes, so people tell me, like vodka. At dinner, I sit next to the abbot, who neither speaks nor understands English. We cast about and find a man who says he speaks both English and French and will interpret for us. Blithely, I begin. A look of consternation washes over the interpreter's face. He grabs at his throat. His eyes start from his head. He cannot understand one word I say. He has never heard anything like my deep South Georgia accent. He will have to get someone to translate me into English. I hang my head in humiliation, but there's nothing I can do. The interpreter gets Norbert, and with Norbert translating me into English and the interpreter translating me into French, I carry on a pretty disjointed conversation with the abbot. Conversation isn't really necessary, though. There's such a feast set before us by tuxedo-attired butlers brought down from Sofia for the occasion. It takes all of our attention and long-range planning to get it eaten. The first course is soup. The second, big slices of chicken and rice, covered with a thick white sauce. The third, veal, peas, beans, and potatoes. The fourth, a pudding with chocolate sauce, and last, apples and coffee. I eat it all, but am unhappy that the Bulgarian government, which no doubt supplied the monastery with the food, should feel that it is necessary to feed us in this fashion. I notice that the abbot eats neither chicken nor veal, but five or six crisply fried mountain trout caught, I presume, in the river that sings outside my window. After dinner, everybody goes to bed. It is all one is able to do in a monastery. But before I actually crawl in, I am visited by a committee carrying a large box of DDT powder. The committee is headed by Professor Doe, the French representative on the commission, an extremely handsome, dignified, and distinguished gentleman who, when not representing his government on a special mission, holds the chair of Greek history at the Sorbonne. In the most businesslike manner, his tanned face, grave and intent, his brown eyes narrowed, he studies every inch of my mattress while Harding and Norbert, the other members of the committee, stand by. It is unnecessary, I am sure. The parts of the monastery I have seen have been spotless. But I am so enchanted by the picture of these three serious-minded men absorbed totally in bedbug research that I keep perfectly quiet. But even if I did talk to Professor Doe, he wouldn't understand me. He doesn't understand my English much better than the interpreter at dinner, and my French, which is most meager, throws him into hysterics. I trot out a few words on him once, and between rolls of chuckles, he gasped, "Your French is most amusing. It is what one might call metaphysical French, a language out of this world." Having dusted my bed to his and Norbert's and Harding's satisfaction, the three of them bid me a brusque good night and depart. Quickly, I shower in water that has been water for only a moment. Before that, it was snow on the mountaintop and cold to the middle of my stomach. I jump into bed. For many minutes, I lie there shivering and then get up and put on a pair of sprawling sheep-lined bedroom slippers with leather soles, which my dear friend, Emmy Smith, had given me as a farewell present when I left Louisville, and a flannel bedrobe, and I root back between the covers. Soon I begin to warm up and grow drowsy. I no longer need the bedroom slippers, but am too sleepy to sit up and take them off. I ease them off with my toes. And that was the last I thought of those bedroom slippers. The next morning I had no time to think of them. I got up early, attended two masses, one in a tiny white chapel where the monks came and went most informally, one even appearing with a broom and a dustpan, and the others in the church where the monks, separated into two choirs, chanted responsively for an hour, making goosebumps rise on my back with the beauty and the eeriness of it. I ate breakfast, visited briefly with the abbot, who was looking delightfully absurd in an old, baggy, dark green sweater on top of his black robes, visited the original kitchen of the monastery, which dates back to the 10th century, and amid a chorus of farewells took off for Sofia. We were practically on the outskirts when the slippers floated into my mind. Immediately I was horrified. Just what would the exarch think when he found those big, out-of-shape, run-over leather-soled shoes in his bed? Now, if they were pink and dainty, Harding and Norbert suggested that I telephone back for them, but I said, stars no. My only hope was that by this time the exarch got around to making up that bed, no one would remember that I had slept in it. But that hope was in vain. The very next day, they came by special messenger to the offices of the American Mission in Sofia and were passed from hand to hand until they finally reached the roommate. Your wife's bedroom slippers, the astounded roommate was informed. She left them in the exarch's bed. End of chapter 22.